Welcome to That Season Air podcast. I'm your host, Gina. Stick with me as I chat to season airs, expats and adventurers across the world, sharing their inspiring stories and interesting insights into living and working abroad. On today's show, we chat to ski instructor and holiday representative, Rob Smith. Having discovered a passion for skiing at a young age, Rob decided the university route wasn't for him, and instead decided to follow his heart to the mountains, pursuing his goal of becoming a ski instructor. In this episode, Rob brings us a wealth of wisdom as we run through the highlights of his 19 seasons across Canada, Japan, Italy, and Austria, as well as his transition to a holiday rep position, setting the foundations for year-round mountain life. Today's show is full of laughs as we discuss Rob's mad Brexit border dash, his pandemic plane ride, the societal pressures surrounding season work, and what it's like to be on a chairlift during an earthquake. Stay tuned for an abundance of advice as we go through Rob's highs, lows, and injuries, and stick with us right to the end to hear Rob's unlikely story of how a legless lady left his ski students in shock. Here's the show. So, Rob, welcome to the show.
Hello.
How are you doing?
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from?
I'm from Bolton in the UK, where there are zero mountains. I've arrived back in Meyerhofen. Obviously, I've been in Meyerhofen for several seasons, back and forth. But now I've kind of made the leap and become a resident in Meyerhofen.
Okay. Yeah. So you're an expat now, not season air.
Yeah, I've changed from season air life to expatriate. Yeah, because we've got that EUV 50 card now.
Are you allowed to say who you're employed by?
It rhymes with Minghams.
And what do you do for a job?
I am a resort representative, so basically a holiday rep.
What age were you when you first started living and working abroad?
I did my first season in 2006 and 7. I did an instructor course. So I started differently. I didn't start in the job I'm in now. I've transitioned into being a holiday rep. I started as a ski instructor. I did a ski course in Banff in Canada, an 11-week course where you learn basically how to be a ski instructor. You live in the mountains, and it wasn't a one way they guarantee you work at the end of it. It was just a full season basically where you go out, do your level one, CSIA, which is the governing body for Canadian ski instructors. Mm-hmm. You do your level one in the second week, and then you do your level two in the, I think, the 11th week, the last week of your season is the exam. And it was a great experience. I got into skiing by doing school trips. My dad was a teacher, and he went to America on his school trips. I didn't go to his school, but it was a bit of a posh school. And it basically started with me. I first wanted just to go to America. That was the draw for me. Oh, I get to go to America. And then skiing was the reason we went, and I just took to it straight away. I really enjoyed skiing, loved the mountains, and was pretty good at it. So I was going with high school, but I was obviously just year seven, and it was older kids and that, but I was the teacher's son. So
what did you want to do when you grew up, when you were in school?
I think there was various things. There was one point I was going to go in the army. I wasn't an academic at school. I was more of a creative. Everyone who I grew up with said I should have like gone into acting or something like that. No, it never really appealed to me. I think I'm too self-conscious for that. But I was always into art and making things with my hands and stuff like that. So through school and stuff, I went to college. I did art. I did a foundation year to get into university to be a fine art student. But during that period, I really fell out of love with art, like just the process. I liked painting. Yeah. I liked doing the things, but I didn't like explaining why I made this brush stroke and all that. So it was too analytical for me.
Right, okay.
And I realized, and my parents realized, that if I went to university, I probably wouldn't have finished university. I'd have done the sesh side of university and not actually
the sesh
done the work part. So at that point, I had started skiing. So I was probably on my third or fourth ski holiday. And then I was like, I might want to be a ski instructor. I kind of said it out loud a few times, and my dad heard that, and my mum heard that, and they were like, well, if you finish your foundation course and you don't want to go to uni, then we helped your sister go to uni, like paid a few bills or whatever. We'll kind of, if you pay half, we'll pay half for this ski course, because it wasn't cheap at the time. And I was like, right, well, I looked into it kind of actively, found this course in Banff, 11 weeks, all these different things, so you get your level two. And then that's obviously a level two you can teach all around the world with that qualification. Mm-hmm. So looked into doing that, and basically saved up for a year and a half working in a cinema, always thinking, right, I'm going to do this ski course at the end of it. And basically, once I did that, I really didn't look back after after I started doing the course. The course was, I think it was 30 of us. And it was a great way to get in there, but it wasn't, I would not say it was the best way to become a ski instructor or become a season air, if you will.
Right.
Everyone who was doing it, I think me and one other person out of the 30 was actually were actively there to become ski instructors and get a job in the industry. Everyone else was doing a gap year. So they were going, doing a full winter season, and then in the summer they were going to Guatemala and doing a volunteering project, which is great, but it was just a stopgap between you.
Yeah,
they're having
it wasn't
a year out.
A career choice.
No,
their
parents were like, well, you're going to have some structure on your year out. You're not just going to stay at home. You're going to go somewhere and do something, which is fine. It met some amazing people there, still friends with them, a lot of people from it. So it was invaluable to be in the mountains doing these different things. And as soon as I finished that course, I went home and got a job. But I'd already made the contacts that got me my first ski instructing job the next season.
How long were you in Canada for?
I've done two stints in Canada. So
I
did 3 years in Banff. So I did, well, I say 3 years. So I did my first season and then I went home and worked for the summer. And then I went back and because obviously the visa system, you have to have a visa. And this would be a pro tip. If you get a season, a visa for a country where obviously you're into your skiing, that's what you want to do. I would always say, I've known people who've just gone for the season and gone home and not used the rest of their year visa or 2 year visa. If you get a year visa or a 2 year visa, stay for the entire time because you see the resorts in such different eyes in the summer as to the winter. They're just as good. I've started to like my summers just as much as I like my winters now. And you maybe have spent more time in Meyerhofen this summer.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And you were always in Lake Garda or wherever.
Exactly, yeah.
So you've maybe seen the
Definitely.
Benefits of being here in the summer. And you see it in a completely different light. It's lots of different people, but you see the same people. And you maybe make better friends because you're not just someone who just comes and goes every winter
exactly,
or whatever.
Exactly, yeah.
So I would always say, if you get a two-year visa, stay for the whole 2 years. You never know where that's going to lead. You might meet someone. You might get a job that you absolutely love. So I did, I've gone off on a tangent.
No, that's good.
But
that's
good.
All good information.
I got a visa to start with, but because I did it so long ago, the visa system has changed so many different times.
Yeah, yeah.
When I got it initially, it was a BUNAC visa, which is a company that does it for you.
Yeah.
You pay them a certain amount of money. Obviously, mm-hmm. you fill out the forms. You have to be eligible for it. You were only allowed one at that point.
Right.
So I had that visa and it gave me a full year. So I went and did my course 06-07, came back 07-08 and stayed for the entirety of 2008. I worked my first ski season as an instructor, which was absolutely fantastic. Still possibly the best job I've ever had being a ski instructor. It was so much fun. It was a smaller hill in Banff. They've got the big three, which is Lake Louise, Sunshine and Norquay. Mm-hmm. I worked in the small one, which is Norquay, isn't like labeled the locals hill. So I worked there and for the first season, I basically paid my dues. I was like, I had little kids, never skied before, couldn't speak English instructing lessons. So the people who've been there a few years obviously got the better lessons where it was like some kid who just wants babysitting and you can ski and you're just flying around the mountain for a week. Didn't get that for the first season. But the second season when I went back, I paid my dues and went back to the same place and got those kind of gigs the next year. So that was good. That was my first visa. And I worked in a golf course, which I had no interest in golf at all. I'm not a golfer. But I had an amazing time doing that in the summer. So it showed that I'd gone to Canada purely for the ski reasons. And then I stayed for a year and had to find a job in the summer. And there was golf course hiring, met loads of actual Canadians then. But the visa situation made me stay there. A lad I knew went home and just couldn't come back. They've changed it now till you get a 2 year visa or something like that. But the reason I could come back the next winter is because I'd done my whole season. I'd done very well. I say very well. I'd performed adequately in my job. I mean, I hadn't thrown up on the chairlift in front of all these kids or whatever like some people did. I did all right. I turned up for work, basically. It meant that they sponsored me to come back the year after. So the ski hill were like, we can guarantee that you work for us. You can only work for them. You can't. It's not like a working visa where I could work at a ski resort in the winter and then in the summer work in a golf course. That option had been taken away because I was sponsored. So my third season was working in the same ski resort. So that was my first 3 year stint. I call it 3 years because it was basically over a 3 year period, but I did one full year and two winters either side of it. And then I decided I wanted to go further afield Brexit wasn't obviously a thing. So I wanted to carry on my ski career. I wanted to work other places. And I always thought, obviously, Europe's on my doorstep. I can ski. I can work in all over Europe, except for France, because their system is very exclusive, shall we
say.
Yes,
it is, yes.
I didn't have enough qualifications for the French. Well, you have to do the French course, which
exactly.
is bullshit.
Very difficult.
I'm not a fan. I've never skied in France.
Have you not?
That's something, yeah.
I learned where I did my first season.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Shell's done seasons there. She loves it. She says, I'm going to love it at some point, but it's been a bit of a sore spot for me because they're just exclusive for no reason. My point was, I was always thinking that Europe was on my doorstep. So with this qualification, I wanted to go as far afield as I could, like just to see how far I could go and see what I could do. Obviously, I worked in Canada. You work with Australians and people from New Zealand. But you do seasons with people from all over the world, which is one of the massive benefits of doing seasons and being a seasonaire.
Like, yeah.
People from all walks of life. So I thought, well, let's see where I can go with it. So I went home in 2009. Hopefully thinking I was going to come back in 2010, but I hadn't decided I wanted to get sponsored. I was going to do my own thing, so I was going to go somewhere else. Things went on, and I ended up just going back for a two-week holiday in 2010, back to Canada, back to Banff, because one of my friends, who is part of a group of my first season friends, she was getting married to a Canadian and living in Canada.
Nice.
So I basically just bought a plane ticket and flew out for 2 weeks and stayed on their couch.
Nice. Aww.
Which was really good, obviously. Another one of that friendship group went out for 1 week. I went for 2 weeks. So we had a week all together, and then she left and I was there for the rest of the time. But unfortunately, I broke my knee skiing while I was there on the baby slope in the hill I worked at.
The baby slope?
Yeah, well, it was the stupidest thing.
I mean, it happens.
Yeah, I was skiing with my friend who was getting married. It was 5 weeks before the wedding. She was skiing in front of me, and I kind of went behind her, if I'm describing this right, and kind of hugged her from behind. And we were turning, we were doing a big snow plow, like you do, I don't know. And our ski brakes got jammed together.
Oh, no.
So we couldn't separate, and she freaked out. She couldn't stop, and I couldn't stop because she was kind of the controlling person. I did the chivalrous thing, and I pushed her as hard as I could away from me to try and like break us free and into a fence, but it immediately backfired and she bounced off that fence and landed on my knee and it went and cracked, and basically my ACL was severed. It wasn't a snap of my ACL. It stretched to a point where it took the chip of bone that was attached to my knee off with it, which sounds horrible, but it actually meant that it wasn't a repair that they need to take a bit of your hamstring and all that. All they had to do was put one screw in that bone and reattach it.
Ah, okay.
So that was good.
Yeah, that was great.
But the only problem was I was in Canada. I hadn't thought about anything because I'd lived in Canada. It was all, I'll just get a plane ticket and stay on my mate's couch. I didn't get any insurance. So I was in agony. I immediately stood up and my knee moved in a way it's never moved before, and I knew instantly something had gone wrong. I was like, So I hobbled to I was at the bottom of the hill, hobbled inside, managed to get my ski boot off. My friend hadn't realized that I was really that hurt. I was like, I've hurt myself, and she was like, oh, you'll be fine. And then hobbled to the house, got my ski gear off, got in the shower, and my knee was
massive.
Three times the size of what it was, and I was like, ooh.
Not good.
And then I was thinking, right, what do I do now? I've got a week. I'm sleeping on someone's couch. I have no insurance. And like in Canada, it's like an American system for people who aren't from Canada. They charge for everything. So if I'd have gone into the hospital, I'd have got an MRI, an X-ray, some crutches and some painkillers, and it'd have been $5,000 or something like that.
Oh my goodness.
So I stuck it out. I was like, right, I'm going to sleep on your couch. My mate had some painkillers that he gave me from a operation he'd had, I think some Percocet or something. So I took some prescribed medication, sat on his couch and just waited it out. But I hobbled through the airport. I didn't have any crutches. So what we'd done, luckily, I found that the day before I'd done my knee, I'd been to the liquor store in Canada to buy some beer. And I noticed my peripheral vision that there were some crutches just outside lying next to a bin outside the liquor store. So I was like, can we go via the liquor store? I want to check something. She was like, okay. Drove past. And they were still there. So I was like, right, go and get them. She ran and got them. And when I got them, like, when I actually got them, I realized, yeah, they were the right height. They weren't too big. They weren't too small. But they were two separate crutches. So it was a big crutch on its smallest setting and a small crutch on its biggest setting. But they worked as a pair. So I'd stolen some poor homeless person's crutches or something. But they'd been there a whole day. So I don't think anyone was missing them. So I spent a week hobbling around my mate's apartment on these hobo's crutches. Right. Managed to get to, I got a taxi to the airport. When I got to the airport, I found that obviously crutching with a ski bag and two bags is very hard. And they've got those trolleys that you have to squeeze to push. Yeah, yeah, I couldn't do that because I had crutches. So I was kind of doing a squeeze, a push, hobble, a push, a squeeze. Oh my goodness. It was a bit comical. Managed to get home. My mum picked me up from Manchester Airport and drove me straight to A&E. Had a scan. They told me exactly what was wrong. Within 2 weeks, they'd scheduled me for surgery. And within a month, I had surgery. And it was like a 12-week recovery. I had lots of physio, lots of different things. Yeah. I didn't miss a season. I went away the next season. But that just wants to emphasize the point of, if you do go anywhere, do get adequate insurance. Because if I'd had insurance, fine. It would have been covered. It'd have been fine. Yeah. But the difference between the system that they have in America and Canada and in the UK, it just shows how invaluable the NHS is. Like, I didn't spend a penny. It would have cost me $5,000 just for them to say, we're not going to operate, but this is what's wrong. See you later. Whereas I hobbled into A&E in Chorley, where I live. Within 2 weeks, I'd had the operation, and then I had 12 weeks of aftercare, including physio. They built, what's it called, a leg brace around my brace, like a bespoke leg brace, shall we say, like these things. And all for nothing, absolutely free, completely free. Not a penny was spent by me. That's the beauty of the NHS.
I'm surprised they let you on the plane, actually.
Yeah.
With you having crutches and everything.
Well, being a rep and having to tell these people, like, oh, well, you're going to have to book an extra seat and all this.
Yeah.
No, nothing. I got there and she was like, oh, you're all right. I was like, I've hurt my leg. And she
this
was
is
like,
not advised, by the way. For anyone listening, this is not the policy of any tour operator.
Didn't have a fit to fly. Didn't have anything. Oh, no one knew what was wrong.
You were
like,
lucky.
Yeah. And she was just like, yeah, right, I'll get you an aisle seat. I was like, brilliant. Cheers. And that was it. And it was 2006, it was 2009, sorry, it's a different time.
Wouldn't happen now, wouldn't
it? Oh, God, no. But, like, yeah, you get that with so many guests. Oh, I'll wing it, it's fine. And you get guests, like, they're in full leg cast. I'll cut it off if they don't let me on the plane. And you're like, not advisable. But I did that. I was that guest. But I'd done it all without a tour operator, shall we say. So, yeah, get insurance, definitely.
Definitely.
And big up the NHS. In conclusion,
one thing that I was going to ask you actually is, how many seasons have you done, Rob?
Well, since 2006-07, I've done a fair few winter seasons, but now I started adding summer seasons, and it just starts going mental, doesn't it, when you start adding summer, including winter summer kind of thing, which I didn't do for the first 10 years or so. I just did ski seasons as a ski instructor and got a rubbish job delivering pizzas or whatever when I got back. But with all of them, I think I'm about 19 seasons now.
Wow. Did you enjoy it, by the way? Did you enjoy Canada?
I absolutely loved it. Other than, obviously, the UK, which is my home, Canada and Austria are the two other places that I could see myself living, where I've been for an extended period of time. It's a place where I could definitely see myself living. I do miss Canada. It's a very nice place. Yeah. The skiing is absolutely amazing. Everything's outdoors. Where I was, obviously, I wasn't living in cities. I lived, obviously, in Banff, which is a national park, loads of wildlife, golf course in the summer. So I was outdoors all the time, mountain biking, hiking, climbing, all that kind of stuff. That's the kind of life that I was attracted to.
Yeah.
So that was the big draw about Canada. Because they have that. And if you wanted to live in a city, they have that. You could live in Vancouver and have it on your doorstep. You can have both, best of both worlds, can't you? So that's what drew me to that. And it's what draws me back to Meyerhofen and to Austria as well. Like, it's the same vibe. But obviously, the good thing about Canada is there's no language barrier.
Yes,
which I'm discovering is very hard to learn another language, for me anyway. If you are going to go somewhere like France or Austria or wherever, it's always good to have a bit of language, because people are so much more friend. Yeah. Not friend. Well, I don't have any German up until to now, and I've been here 4 years now, and it's a very friendly place. But I think if you make the effort to try and do it in Deutsch, Deutsch, not German. If you try and do it in Auf Deutsch, they really do respond to you, and obviously, and especially in France, because if you don't speak French. And
it, I mean, can be a bit difficult, yeah, can't it?
Well, I've never skied in France, but I've been to the cultural center of France 3 times. Euro Disney. 3 times to Euro Disney, nowhere else in France. I've seen what it's
very
got
cultural
to offer. Oh yeah, Euro Disneyland.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
After Canada, you went back to the UK.
I did go back to the UK with a broken knee. I had basically a summer of convalescence.
Oh, okay.
It was, incidentally, a summer where the World Cup was on, so I enjoyed it immensely. The South African World Cup was on. It was great. I went to my mates in London and whatever, so I had a good time. But the best thing about it was my recovery. It happened in April, and I was ready to ski again in November, so I didn't miss a season.
Fantastic. So where was next then?
I went to Japan. I did a season in Japan, which was absolutely nothing like I'd ever done before. I'd never been to that side of the world before. My mate, who I'd met in Canada, just sent me a link while I was convalescing with my bad knee. He was like, oh, this company, it was an Australian company that I got it through, are doing a season air kind of thing. That's a ski instructor in Japan, learning Japanese as a second language kind of thing as well, which was rolled up into the reason why you get the job. Applied.
What company was it?
It's called Boo Boo Ski. I don't know if they still exist. It was 2010 that I got that job. So two Aussie blokes set it up. I think they lived in Japan. And it was basically you can get a Japanese visa for one year working abroad. You've got to show that you can study and you can support yourself to get that visa. It's like the Canadian visa was, but for Japan.
Has it changed now, or is it still the same?
I'm not sure. I think it's still part of the. I've not looked into it for a long time, but when I was doing it, it was called the Young Persons Mobility Scheme, where it gives young people from kind of reciprocal countries. So if Japanese can go to England, England can go to Japan. Canada, UK, kind of same thing.
Yeah.
And it was people you could get that visa up until you were 30, and it gives you 1 year in that country where you can work in most industries except for like childcare and a few other like specific where you need special kind of qualifications. But you can work in a shop, you can work in a museum, you can work in, you know, like as a receptionist at a dentist if you wanted to. It's basically to open people's minds up to other cultures and be able to live and work in another country. But my friend sent me the link. I applied in like writing, obviously sent my CV, filled out their form, did a Skype interview, and then they were like, yeah, we think you're a perfect candidate. We've got one resort in Hokkaido, which is the North Island of Japan, 2 hours away from Sapporo, that are looking for British-speaking instructors. One of the criteria of getting the job was I had to do Japanese lessons over Skype for about 6 weeks before I went. It was included in the package.
Do you remember any of it?
Squashy, which means a little. You answer the phone by going mushy mushy. So no, I don't.
Well, I was impressed with that. That's
I struggle with most languages. I did the Skype lessons. I went out and I only did the one season in Japan. Before we arrived as Western instructors, they'd not had Western employees. It had always been Japanese employees, and it's a big resort that I worked in. It was called Rizutsu. So it's about 45 minutes away from Niseko. Now, Niseko is obviously the big one in Hokkaido. It's the one that everyone kind of knows. If you know anything about Japanese ski resorts, that's like kind of like the Whistler of Japan, where we were 45 minutes away. It's a very strange place. Very strange. As in, it's just weird. They have weird things there. Like, so in the reception of the hotel, they've got a 1940s fully working merry-go-round that they've imported from Germany with the horses that go up and down.
Right.
And you just push a button and you can get on and go around. They also have like a robotic tree that sings to you in there. They've got really weird things there.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, it is interesting, but it's interesting seeing skiing through a Japanese lens almost. Like, you can see they have a completely different way of looking at skiing as Westerners do, and people in Canada and people in Europe maybe. I always remember every morning, because it'd be amazing amounts of snow. So they didn't open we got there in November. They didn't open till like mid-December because the snow wasn't good enough. And we were looking out the window like, this is the best snow I've ever seen. Like, if that was anywhere else in the world, everyone would be out skiing and just in the powder. But it wasn't perfect. It wasn't enough. And like, we were like, how much more do they need?
Yeah.
And then it came, the snow came in like mid-December to the point where it was above the cars. You couldn't see your car. It was just a mound of snow. You had to dig it out in the morning. And it just snowed like that for like a month. Like every morning there would be fresh snow.
Wow.
And it would be so, they'd have to dig out the chairlifts and whatnot. So we were every morning getting the work bus into work, getting our ski gear on, just, we had an hour before lessons and we would just go and ski like as much as possible. And you'd walk past all the Japanese instructors and they'd all be watching a video about the perfect snow plow. And like, there'd be like 20 of them huddled around the TV, like taking notes about technique. And we were like, the snow, look outside, there's so much, why are you not going skiing,
why are you not on it?
And they were like, ah, the perfect snow plow. Like, and we were like, okay, see you later, more for us. And we just went skiing every morning, so that was different. Obviously they're very into their technique. Also when we were there, I mean, I'm sure because there's more and more Westerners go there now, it's a place where lots of people would go from the UK. Our company has started doing a few holidays there. I don't know if going, maybe. But there's like lots of companies that go and take you to several resorts in Japan and you can ski around. So there are lots, there's a market, and that's why I got my job. Sorry, this is the tangent. I'm coming back full circle.
It's okay.
The reason that I'd got a job, before it was, say, 4 or 5 Japanese instructors that could speak broken English. And I mean, my kind of style of German, not really much English, just bend, turn, stop.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So they realized that they were getting a lot of customers from Australia who want to ski proper snow instead of Australian, New Zealand kind of good snow, but obviously powder.
Yeah.
And people from Hong Kong, their second language is English. It's not Japanese. So they needed a group of us to come and do it. And we were the trial, basically. This Boo Boo Ski was brought in to recruit for them, brought about 15 to 20 of us out, a mixture of British people and Australians. And we all lived in the same little place. It was a staff accom. It was like a purpose-built staff accom for this resort. And we were the trial, and it's still going now. They've still got loads of instructors. I think I still see it on Facebook, like at that resort. So it's got bigger and bigger each year. Lots of people go, and it's a great place to go, but it's mental. They've got ponies on the slope and stuff. Like, there's just like a little stable halfway down one of the runs, and there's just like little Shetland ponies that the owner's just, he just buys things frivolously, I think. He's got 6 roller coasters and like a monorail. That goes between 2 hotels, and they've got one of those, like, you know, those robotic bands that are like teddy bears and they play like the ukulele and sing. They've just got weird things.
Sounds very interesting.
It's a very interesting, weird place, but
very culturally different.
Very culturally different. The skiing was absolutely amazing. Fantastic. Yeah. The most powder I've ever seen. You could jump off like a 10-foot cliff and you'd be fine. No problems at all. You'd just land in the snow. When I said I was going to Japan, to a lot of people, oh yeah, it's great. It's like, people who'd never been were saying, oh, well, they're really into their wanting to learn English. They all try and speak English. They won't even let you speak Japanese because they all want to learn English and speak English. Mm-hmm. That is not true where I went. No one spoke English. It was like this rural little town. In the summer, they farm asparagus. In the winter, they've got the ski resort. And it was just like, there was one little karaoke bar that we went to a few times. And there was a 7-Eleven where we did our shopping. But they don't speak any English. I got a phone through the company. Their network was called SoftBank. It was in English on the phone, said SoftBank. And I went to top up my phone. And the girl in 7-Eleven was like, I was like, SoftBank? 100 yen or whatever it was. I can't remember. It's a while ago. I was like, SoftBank money. Can I top up the phone? She was like, oh, I don't understand. Like, obviously, I was speaking English. I wasn't speaking Japanese. Not her fault. We were in Japan. I said it about 4 times, SoftBank. I want to put money on this phone to call. And she was like, oh. And then something clicked in her head and she was like, oh, SoftBanko. And I was like, that wasn't that far from what I was saying. I was saying SoftBank and you said SoftBanko. And she was like, yeah, did it, no problem. But that's the difference between, they just don't understand English and where I was. Obviously, there is lots of places, Tokyo, you go Tokyo, wherever, there'll be lots of places where they speak perfect English and Japanese.
Yeah.
But it was a bit of a rural town where I was. They struggled with the understanding of me going, SoftBank, SoftBank, 100 yen.
So quite an experience in Japan then.
Yeah, yeah. Again,
a real Japanese experience.
Completely different to what I'd done before or since.
So how long were you there for? 1 year, did you say?
No, I could have been there for a year, and I had planned to do my ski season, which was, it's a shorter season, so it's like, December till like mid-March, but I was going to stay longer and travel, go to the main island, get the bullet train, go to Tokyo and all these different things. Mm-hmm. But I was there when the big earthquake happened in 2011. Fukushima nuclear power plant melted down. So we were there, like, it was weird. Like, I heard the earthquake from the chairlift, big rumble. Didn't know what it was, obviously. I was like, oh, it seems like thunder or something. And got back to the kind of clubhouse where we all the instructors were, and all the Japanese instructors were huddled around this tiny TV, like watching it, and you could just see the wave and these cars being washed away, and
someone was like,
there's been a huge earthquake, and like there's been a tsunami, and then for the next week it was just people trying to contact home, and all the Japanese people like ringing home because they'd come from the main island to work, and the phone lines went dead, and it was really strange kind of time. And then obviously my mum was ringing me saying, this nuclear power plant has melted down. There's radiation in the air. What's happening? And I was like, it's fine. No, it's... because that's the information that was coming out of Japan at the time. They were like, there is no problems. There has been a minor problem. No meltdown, none of this. But like the readings from everywhere else were saying, there's been a meltdown. There's a problem. Radiation is in the air. And the Japanese kind of, they were just saying, no, it's fine. Nothing went wrong. It was a minor blip, but they were in full meltdown. So I was going to travel from the main island, from Hokkaido down to the main island, but I was going to get the ferry across that had been washed away. Oh, all the trains were disrupted, everything. So it was just like, go home. And also the British consulate were saying, if you're a British national, come home because there's radiation in the air. I think I came back 2 weeks earlier than my flight was previously booked for. It was British Airways did it for free because it was like Foreign and Commonwealth Office advice to come home. You didn't have to pay like £100 admin fee that they charge you. So it ended abruptly. It ended where I obviously wanted to see a lot more of the country, and I do really, really want to go back to ski and to see obviously more of Japan. But it was a very strange time that I was there, and it ended.
Sounds it.
Yeah.
After Japan, what happened next? Where were you?
I wanted to go back to Japan. The visa system that they had was, if you wanted to get sponsored by them, they could only sponsor, the only way they had a sponsored visa, like the one where I did it with Canada, they said, oh, you have the qualification to do this job, we know you can do this job, we'll employ you again. In Japan, they couldn't do that. Their system was, the people who wanted to go back could apply for a student visa. So if you had a degree from the UK or wherever, they could sponsor you that way to go and learn Japanese.
Right, okay.
And that was their loophole. Yeah. But I didn't have a degree because I'd done ski seasons. Yes. So I decided
to go. You didn't have your art degree.
I went a different way. Yeah, that was weird. Like, so if I'd got an art degree, I could have gone back to Japan to be a ski instructor. But because I didn't have that, I couldn't go back.
We make our choices.
Yeah, we got to live with them. But yeah, it all happens for a reason.
Exactly.
So I found a ski company in Italy. It's called Interski, based in the UK. Do school trips for kids, coach trips. I'd been on a coach trip as a school kid with my school, not with my dad's school. I went skiing when I was, I think, about 13, year 9 or something. Mm-hmm. Went to Aosta, Pila in the Aosta Valley, and I did a season there. That was just because it was somewhere a company I knew. I just typed in, it's how you find these jobs, isn't it? Like, I just typed in something I knew. I typed in Interski. That came up and it said, one of the links was work for Interski. I clicked on that button and just followed it. And they were like, oh, right, okay, so you're a ski instructor. But I was applying not for a ski instructor. I was applying for a rep job. So it was a different job because the way they do it is, if you are a British instructor or an international instructor that doesn't have an Italian qualification, I think you can only work up to 4 or 5 weeks in Italy.
Oh, I didn't
know. So what they did was they brought out instructors on a weekly basis. So it was basically people who were done their ski instructor qualification, had probably done a season or two somewhere, and then gone home and been professionals and got proper jobs, and they're accountants and they're teachers and all these different things. So when they got a week holiday, they could do this. They could they could be a ski instructor for a week. So they get paid to be a ski instructor, but obviously they get their travel and their food and their accommodation all paid for, but they're on the snow for a week. So that's how they did it. But I was doing it as a full season. So I became one of their reps. It wasn't the best scenario, as in, like, our week now is like Saturday to Saturday, isn't it?
Yeah.
Their week is Saturday to Sunday, but there's no day where you don't have guests. So it was basically 5 months, no days off. I had to work 5 months with no day off.
Right.
And they sell it that you have a rep with you every single day. They arrive on the coach. You get on the coach. You introduce yourself. You say, right, we're going to go into the rental shop. You get their skis. You get their boots. They put them in their little lockers. They get back on the coach. And then you get on the coach with them and go back to the hotel where they're staying. And you stay in that hotel.
Intense repping.
Yeah, it is. And then every single day you've got a requirement. So you get up, you have breakfast, and then you take them to the ski hire shop, you get all their stuff, they go up to the mountain, you get them to the lesson, and you see them off to the lesson. And then the only free time you have is when they're in their lesson. So you can ski all day if you wanted to with your other friends. And then you pick them up from lessons, take them back to the hotel,
wow.
You have dinner, and then there's a bowling night, a pizza night, a disco night. So it's one of those where it's full on for 5 months.
Very busy, yeah.
I wouldn't recommend it.
Did you enjoy Italy? Is that the only season you've done in Italy?
I did enjoy Italy. I mean, I've done a summer season in Italy.
Had you done that before?
No, this is my first time in Italy. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great. Met some fantastic people. Yeah, I mean, it was very English abroad heavy because you were just dealing with English school kids. Mm-hmm. Everyone who was employed by the company were English, so there wasn't much learning the language. Some people actually really did well and did well learning the language and could speak some Italian when they finished.
Yeah.
I was not one of those people. but I enjoyed it. I mean, it was a grueling schedule. You just make the most of it. You find ways around it, don't you?
Mm-hmm. You say you did a season in Italy for the winter and you've also done a summer. When did you start doing summers?
My first summer was in 2016. So I did a season in a holiday camp unrelated to anything to do with skiing in Lake Garda. I worked for a British company again, obviously that's who we're employing, called Alfresco. I think they're part of Eurocamp now. They call it rep job, but basically you clean static caravans. You clean those, you check people in, someone's cooker doesn't work, you fix it. But it was a really fun experience.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it, and Lake Garda is amazing.
I will just go back to the ski seasons again, because obviously you've done quite a few ski seasons. You did Canada, Japan, then Italy. You went to Italy. What other countries have you done seasons in?
I went back to Canada then for 2 years.
Right.
So I went back, but I went to a different place. I went to Whistler this time instead of Banff. I went to Whistler, so the two main ski areas in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit of what happened was I met a girl in Italy doing the same job. And then I'd always decided that I was kind of going through the visa process as I was working in Italy for Canada, because I was only eligible for that one visa for Canada where I did 3 years ago or whatever, with the first BUNAC visa. But BUNAC had stopped doing the visa and the Canadian government had taken over that process, which meant it wiped the slate clean for me and I could reapply for a visa.
Right. Brilliant.
Which was good. So I applied for that and got it. Met this girl in Italy and I was like, I'm going to Canada. Would you like to come? And she was like, yeah, sounds great. Went to Canada. Spent 2 years there in Whistler as an instructor again, not as a rep. Really good fun. A lot better set up than it was in Banff because it's much more of a professional organization. It's not just a group of instructors. You get kids, you get this. It was like you have certain departments. So you can work with the very young kids. You can work with the medium kids. You can work with the teenagers. If you get employed by that department, you work for that department. You don't just get, on Monday you get a group of kids, on Tuesday you get a private, and Wednesday you get a group of teenagers.
Yeah, it's nice and structured.
Yeah, and it paid well because certain jobs in certain places you can get paid quite poorly as a ski instructor. My first year in Banff, I got paid for the hours that I was on snow. So you could teach a maximum of 4 hours, like 2 in the morning and then 2 in the afternoon. That's not a lot of money because you're getting paid $14 an hour at that time. But I arrived at the ski hill at 7 in the morning because you have to get the staff bus, and then you have to get the staff bus at the end of the day, which is at 6 o'clock in the evening. So I'm there from 7 in the morning, 6 in the evening, and you get paid for 4 hours during the day. So you'd pick up other things where you'd help out in rentals for an hour in the morning, or you'd do the sweep of the mountain that the ski patrol do to make sure that there's no one stuck in the trees or whatever. In my second season, I had to supplement my wage, and I did a full day in the gift shop, just working there, yeah, just because I couldn't earn enough money to kind of survive. Well, not survive, but live. So I did it that way. But in Whistler, when I was working in this department, it was, as soon as you get to work, you clock in and you pick up the kids and you've got them all day and you give them back and you get paid for every minute, even at lunch, because you're looking after them at lunch. So you get this, it's not just 4 hours that you're teaching, it's the whole day.
Okay.
So it's much better. So yeah, we were there 2 seasons. I did 2 winters, and in the middle I worked in Blackcomb as a trampoline kind of person.
A trampoline person.
So at the bottom of Whistler, they've got like a little kind of, I don't know, well, I don't know what you'd call it, like a little kind of play area for the kids. And different companies work there. And I work for one of the companies where you have those bungee trampolines where you attach bungee cords to a harness and you ping people up in the air. it was called Kiss the Sky. It was owned by an old ski racer from Whistler. He was quite a well-known guy, and he'd bought this company. And there was a trapeze, and there was all these different things with airbags and stuff. It was fun. And I became like one of the supervisors there. So I did that, and then I did another winter. And then at the end of that, the girl I was with decided she didn't really want to do skiing anymore. Mm-hmm. And I thought I was in love. So I was like, yeah, okay, let's stop doing seasons. Oh, and no. So I moved. I didn't even go home. She was from Folkestone. I'm from Bolton. That's obviously the length of the UK. I lived in the northwest. She lived in the southeast. So I didn't even go home. I went straight from Canada, moved in with her parents for 5 months. And then we got our own flat. And I was working in B&Q at the start. And then I worked, which was the worst decision of my life, worked in a call center. I was selling travel insurance to people over the phone, and it was just, oh, it was soul destroying. At that point, I thought I was in love and I wanted to see where it was going, blah, blah, blah. And I just wasn't ready to stop doing seasons because I'm still doing them now.
Yeah.
So I did that for 2 years. It eventually split. This is where I'm getting to. We eventually split up because obviously I wasn't happy because I was working in this job and I wanted to do other things. Yeah. She wasn't happy because she wanted to do other things, blah, blah, blah. She wanted to do something with her life that wasn't what I wanted to do with my life. We were doing separate directions.
Totally different,
So within 2 weeks of splitting up, I'd gone home back to Bolton from Folkestone. And within 2 weeks of being back in Bolton, I was in Lake Garda doing a season. I went straight back to what I knew. I got an interview, and I was actually at a training day. I was going to be doing like home care for the elderly and people with like disabilities. So you go, they have a home and they can live, but you go around and make sure that everything's right, do a bit of tidying, make them some food. I was doing that, and then my mate, who I'd done a season with before, she was like, oh, I'm going to Italy to work in Altomincio for Alfresco. And I was like, all right, yeah. Like, it was just an impassing kind of comment. And then I kind of Googled it, and I was like, I'm going to apply. I applied and got the job, and I was like, worked in the same, I just turned up, and I was like, oh yeah. And she's like, oh.
You again.
You're following me. Just showed that I wasn't ready to quit my seasons.
Yeah.
I went back to something I knew straight away from where I was like, obviously a bit down in the dumps. I just split up with someone that I thought I was going to be with forever. We'd been together for 4 years. Yeah. Like, I got dumped as well. Like, she was like, I don't think we should be together anymore. And I was like, yeah, probably not. But I wasn't the one who's going to be the one to pull the trigger. And so I immediately went back to something I knew. I went back to seasons. I went back to being abroad and doing this kind of job. And I immediately felt straight at ease with it. I was like, well, this is what I should have been doing. I shouldn't have been working in a bloody call center selling travel insurance. I should have been traveling instead.
Well, you found your way back to it anyway.
I did. It called me.
It called you back, yeah.
I was finding myself again. I was learning to love me. I mean, obviously, it takes a while to get over a breakup, and especially a breakup where you think there was never going to be a breakup. That was the one. The reason I finished seasons was because I was moving in with it. We were going to have kids. We got a house. We got a car. We got a cat. Two cats.
Wow.
So I proper put roots down. It wasn't I'd half-assed it and was like, oh, I want to do another season. It was like, I'd gone all in.
Yeah, that was the scenario.
And then it blew up. And within 2 weeks, I was back doing seasons in Lake Garda. So it took a while. Like, I was going to be living with mum and dad again. Because obviously, doing jobs like this, you don't have a base, do you? You basically have a place to leave a bag or two. You go and do a season, or you go and do 2 years away in Canada. And you don't have somewhere where you call. You got your mum and dad's place, but it's your mum and dad's place. My sister had finally moved out, and she's 4 years older than me. She'd done the same thing. She'd been off and doing different things, like in the country, in the UK. She's not a seasonaire or anything, but she'd had a breakup with her boyfriend, and she'd moved back home while I was away. And then I come back just as she leaves. So they'd never had no kids in the house, and they're in their 60s, and we're like, so old. We shouldn't be living with our parents. So I just felt like I was under their feet. Obviously, they weren't saying go away. They were welcoming me with open arms, but I felt like I was under feet. So I immediately was like looking as a way out. And if it wasn't abroad, it would have been having to get a really proper serious job and pay rent somewhere. And I wasn't up for that at all. I was just like, no, that's one of the benefits in seasonal life is a lot of the time you get accommodation included, or you get various things included where you don't actually have to put a deposit down on a place to live, or you don't have to make very serious life choices. And most jobs that I have had have included the accommodation because, again, you've probably never been to the resort that you're going to be trying to get a place to live in. So it needs to be included, really. So the
It is doable. It's just
it is doable, a bit more effort. And you have to arrive maybe a month before your job starts to look for a place, have enough money to support yourself while you're looking, and then if you're going to get a rental place, maybe they will ask for a deposit or something like that. So it is, it's 100% doable. And that's what I did in Canada the first time when I went to Banff. After my first training year, the second year, me and a friend who did the same course went back together. And we were like, right, well, we don't want to live in their staff accom because we want to have our own house. And that, that was the idea that we had. But then we got to Banff and realized that there is no accommodation for anyone because it's a national park and there's huge restrictions on what you can build. You can't build like big staff accoms. They all have to be a certain level.
Right.
And there's not a lot of places to live. And obviously it's a season air place. So they, a lot of places don't rent to people who are want a season air's house. So we spent our first month living in the YWCA, which is like the YMCA, but for women. So it was the old converted hospital in Banff. They changed it into a hostel when they moved the hospital out of town. So we lived there for a month and scoured the papers, looking for places to move into. Just really struggled to find anyone. And then we went back cap in hand to like, you know when we said we didn't want staff accom? Can we have staff accom now, please? And they were like, no. Because there wasn't any. They got rid of it all. So we're like, oh God, what are we going to do? So we ended up living out town and for a while. And then we finally got into staff accom.
Okay.
And it was the better decision. So yeah, I'd always say staff accom was a good thing. Definitely for your first season, because the second, it's like uni. You want halls for the first year because you don't know who you want to live with and blah, blah, blah. And then the second year, if you go back for another season, then you know everyone you know you want to live with. There's a room somewhere.
Yeah.
It's so much easier to find accommodation the second year than it is if you've never been there before.
That's a good tip, actually. Yeah. Did you find your mojo?
Yeah, I mean, I knew I'd found a bit more happiness where I, after about a couple of weeks, I realised this is what I should have been doing. I shouldn't have been just doing a job because I thought that's what everyone, because like I'm 35 now. At that time, what was I, 31 maybe? I can't do the maths. I was around 31 and like obviously none of my mates have done seasons. I'm the only one who skis out of my friends. No one understands what I'm doing. They've all got proper jobs, wives, children. That's what I was thinking. Well, I need to get on this because that's what everyone's doing. Like I felt a little bit of societal pressure, shall we say, where I felt, well, I should be doing that because I'm just taking the piss now. I've done too many seasons now. So I that was my attempt at that. My 2 years working and living in a call center and whatever, doing that. And it just didn't take. And so I'd gone from that back to something that I loved. And I was like, I don't think I'll do that again. I won't do it for the sake of doing it, because that's what I felt like I was doing at the end. I was doing it for the sake of doing it for, but well, everyone else is, I should be doing the same thing. I should be getting a proper job. I should have children. I should be doing this, that, that. So that was the realization. I'm more suited to being, not abroad, but doing something that I like doing. Yeah, it doesn't pay well. It's not maybe the best career choice, as in like I'm going to be a CEO. I mean, yeah, I could be. Who knows what the future holds? But it wasn't a clear progression in a career way. I wasn't like, I'd started at the bottom and I was going to be a manager and then I was going to be an area manager, blah, blah, blah. I realized I valued what I was doing, the quality of life side of it, more than the money side of it and more than what other people thought I should be doing. So I realized that in Italy, and that was where I found my mojo again, where I felt, oh, I should be doing this instead of the other thing I was doing. The person that told me about the job in Lake Garda, she incidentally was someone I worked with in a bowling alley in Bolton, and she was really like jealous of the jobs that I'd been doing. She's like, oh, I'm gonna do something like that. It seems like that. I'd inspired her. Maybe she went and did a full year in Australia and worked in Melbourne in a hat shop or something, and worked, did farming work and all that kind of stuff, and she was well into seasons, and she'd just come off doing a season in Hinterglen. She was like, well, I've been to Hinterglen, I work for this company, I think you'd really enjoy it. Obviously, I've got a background from the ski resorts and skiing. I was like, oh, yeah, all right then. But I knew I didn't want to go home and get a proper job at that point.
Yeah.
I wanted to do another ski season. At that point, I was saying, I've got another one in me. I've got one more ski season in me.
As we all do.
Yeah, just one more. And that's what I told my parents when I was back from Italy. I was like, I'm going to go to Austria. So I applied and they placed me in Austria. They placed me in Meierhofen. And mm-hmm. I was like, all right, yeah. The only thing I knew about Meierhofen at that point was snow bombing. I'd never been to Austria, never skied in Europe other than Italy. So I knew I was going to Meierhofen. I was going to be there as a rep. So turned up in Meierhofen. Enjoyed it. Fast forward to the middle of the season, I was like, I don't want to not do this again.
Yeah.
And they were saying, well, you should maybe try a summer. And I was like, what, in Austria, in Meierhofen? And they were like, yeah, I think it'd be good. Did it, loved it. I was like, oh, this is amazing. Like, met this lady who sat next to me.
Rob's girlfriend is in the studio today. Say hello, Shel.
Hello.
So we met, we worked for separate companies. Star-crossed lovers, Romeo and Juliet. The reason I liked Austria was because it was outdoors, like Canada. There was climbing, there was hiking, there was whitewater rafting. There was all these different things that were just available like they were in Canada. And I was thinking, this is a great vibe and I really enjoyed it. So I carried on doing it. And then that rolled into my next winter, which rolled into my next summer.
Where did you meet? Were you in the same resort? Were you both here?
Yeah, we met in the room over there.
Really?
Yeah. Our first meeting was... just over there.
Mike Sports Bar.
Place where lovers meet. Yeah, actually, our first meeting was in the room next door. Luckily, we were able to keep it going because both our companies sent us to the same resort then the winter after. We both went to St. Anton. She came over to my company, our company. She moved from hers. And yeah, now we live together, work together. She's been my boss. I've been her boss. Yeah. So, yeah, it's rolled on from that first, that one more season. I've got one more in me.
Yeah.
Has rolled on. The only season I've missed since then was the COVID summer, last summer.
What was your COVID experience? What was your pandemic experience?
Yeah. So, all my seasons has rolled on to one another and I was happy to carry on. We were in Meierhofen and we were set to do a summer in Meierhofen. And then obviously, around January, February, all the news turned to things happening in China, and I was kind of like, well, doesn't really concern me, we're going to be fine, it's China, like so far
that's
away.
It's really far, yeah.
It got to March, and then it got more and more real. We were like, they were sending us things like, right, you need to clean every single day, you need to be polishing every doorknob with all the different disinfectants to try and keep this down, because it made the leap. Yeah. It was in Italy.
And you were working for Ingham's,
yeah,
with the chalet work as well. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I was the rep at the time, and we got a call overnight. It was like, yeah, the guests that are going home on Saturday are your last guests. We're not getting any more because the situation has changed so drastically that we just can't carry on. So get all the guests out, and it was also like the chalet staff and your other rep, Mark, he's going as well.
Right.
You two are the last ones who are staying. Like, we're sending everyone with the last guests, and you're going to be here to kind of like shut things down, turn all the lights off, make sure the chalet's locked up, kind of thing. We said goodbye to everyone, went to the airport, got everyone off on their way, what, a month earlier than it should have been?
13th of March.
Yeah, 13th of March, and our season was till the 13th of April, so a good month before we were set to finish. We were in Meierhofen on our own with no... with no guests.
Were the guests freaking out?
They came out in uncertain times. It was a bit like everyone was thinking, oh, this is getting a bit more real. It's getting more like, at that point, Italy were doing so badly. It was so strange. Like, it was like, why Italy? Why nowhere else?
Yeah.
Obviously, I hadn't made the leap to everywhere else. We had to shut down the chalet, so we started cleaning it and started. But we were doing the job of four people when it was just us two and no time to do it. And as we were doing it, we found out, obviously, they'd gone into lockdown in Meierhofen, well, gone down into lockdown in Austria. So you could only go out for work and all the hallmarks of a lockdown. But this was the first time it happened. So it was a really, really strange experience. Obviously, you experienced it as well.
Yes.
So we had to stop cleaning the chalet because people in that building had got it. So we couldn't go back in. So we just left it as it was, like in the midst of the clean. So, you know, it always gets worse before it gets better. It was at that point where it was really bad. And then we spent 2 weeks living in our accommodation. Lovely accommodation, lovely place to live. We didn't want to leave until the company had managed to liaise with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and got an emergency flight for all their staff to get out of the country to get us home. So they flew us home on the 21st?
28th.
On the 28th of March back to Birmingham. Picked up COVID on the flight.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I got COVID on the flight.
Oh,
so
no.
I was fine for a week when I got home. No problems. And then on like the Friday, felt a bit ill And I wasn't breathing bad or anything like that. I had the worst headache I've ever had in my life, and it just stayed for 10 days. So it was just awful experience that way. So good souvenir from the season. I got better, obviously. We got proper jobs again.
What were you doing?
I was of the mindset, well, when we go back for summer in Austria, it won't last long. I was thinking, we went back in March, I was thinking, August, we'll be back in Meyerhof and we'll be doing our season, it'll be fine. Shell was not of that opinion. She was like, I don't think summer's going to happen. Like, we were pretty sure that, obviously, winter was definitely going to happen. Yeah. But summer was a write-off in Shell's mind. I still had a little bit of hope. Shell knew it, so she was like, I'm going to have a job. So she started working in Morrison's in the bakery, and I started working for Amazon. I was working in the warehouses, picking, packing, all that kind of stuff. Like I say, it was a job. It was a good job, as in it employed me, it paid me. I stuck it out for 9 months, but I knew I was coming back out here. That was my plan, obviously, the whole time. Yeah. So we spent our summer doing that and always thinking, when are we going to get back out to Austria? Yeah. When are we going to do this? We'd already decided before the pandemic that we were going to do this for the next good few years, enjoying our life and traveling and working. But then obviously the pandemic shut down the summer. And then the closer you get to winter last year, obviously, like the start, like November, they had another lockdown. Mm-hmm. And then we were still set to come out. We were set to come out on the 27th of December was our flight. And then the second variant in the UK came out and all the travel was halted in the UK. So all flights were cancelled. Austria said, well, they're all cancelled till at least 5th of January 2021, which is beyond the withdrawal agreement. Austria had set out the stipulations that if you're here before the 31st of December 2020, you have the same rights to be here on the 1st of January 2021 as you did if there was no Brexit. But you have to be here. You can't turn up on the 2nd of January and be like, oh, I'm here. It's like, no, you've missed the boat on that one. So we needed to get back to Austria before the 31st. So the 27th was obviously cutting it fine, but the company had sorted it all out. Yeah. We were getting flights and it was going to be still enough time to get all registered and be in the country and be fine. But once that travel ban came in, there weren't any flights. You just couldn't fly. Oh, and obviously the company couldn't sort us out any other mode of transport because the borders were closed. France closed the border at Dover. Mm-hmm. That caused loads of problems. There was tailbacks, all that. So during the midst of this, I lost a bit of hope. I was like, we're not going to make it back. Mm-hmm. What are we going to have to do? We're going to have to carry on with our jobs. I'd quit my job at Amazon at that point. And so Chell, she'd quit her job in a week before because we were definitely set to go out. This variant wasn't on the cards at that point. And then once that came in, I was like pretty resigned, like, oh, it's not going to happen. Unfortunately, we left it too late, or we tried, and it's just impossible. And Shell was like, oh, I think we can still do it. There's still hope. We've got to do this. And it kind of was like, oh, I thought she was going to be like, oh, yeah, well, we can't do it. It's like, call it off as a bad job. It's just not going to happen. But she was like, no, no, we can do this. So I was like, so on the drive back from Sheffield, I was ringing P&O ferries and finding out how long the border was going to be closed. And the next day, Shell bought a car from her gran. She like bought a car. I got it insured. I found some PCR tests that you can get in Liverpool. So on Christmas Eve, we drove to Liverpool, got a private test, got the results, obviously negative. And then I bought a car, got it MOT'd, got all the things fixed, got it insured, got ourselves ferry tickets, PCR tests. And then we set off on Boxing Day. So it was a mad dash to the border to get in by the 31st. So
really wanted to get in.
Yeah, we really did. So we set off, got to Dover, no cars. The army did another test at the border because we showed our negative test. That got us through the border. Right. And then they just said, right, you have to have another test, like do it in the car. Got through at the actual French border where the woman says, show me your papers. Why are you traveling? We were like, oh, we live in Meyerhof and we've got jobs. And she was like, prove this to me. So we showed her, because we had everything printed, showed her our contracts, showed her these different things. And she was like, yep, no problem. So you go. So we were dead excited. But then the only other hurdle was we had to get through France, through Germany, and then into Austria. We didn't think there was going to be any problem between France and Germany, but it was just getting into Austria because Austria was going into a lockdown on Boxing Day. So the day we set off, they went into lockdown. You went into lockdown.
We did.
So we got to Kufstein at about 1 o'clock in the morning, 27th, and there was a roadblock. And we were like, oh God, what if they turn away at this point? Yeah. We're so close. And like, there was like a few army kind of Red Cross kind of, you know, they were all at the border like, hi. It's like, what's your purpose for travel? We were like, oh, we live in Meyerhof, and they asked for our contracts, showed our contracts, and he was like, just give us the nod. And we drove through. And what time did we arrive in Meyerhof? We arrived, I think, at about 3 o'clock in the morning in Meyerhof on the 27th. And it was just like, I think I'd been holding my breath from when we set off at 3 o'clock in the morning on Boxing Day until we got to Ireland. And we did like a little dance when we got out to our accommodation. It was just like, it was the maddest dash to the border we've ever attempted. It was just get everything, get to the border, get here, because everything rides on being here before the 31st.
And well done.
The anxiety started to dissipate in like February, where we're just like, oh, we're still here. This is great.
What have you been doing since?
A lot of skiing. Well, we obviously got here with a thought that we were going to have guests, we were going to have people here, we were going to, and the pandemic has had other things to say, shall we say. It's just, it's not gone the way that everyone's hoped. It just keeps getting pushed back, and I'm staying positive. I'm not losing hope. I'm thinking the industry is 100% going to bounce back. The amount of people that have talked to me who they just want to go on holiday, and some people have missed two seasons.
That's like, right. Yeah. So of all the places that you've been to, if someone could only go to one of those places, which one would you advise them to go to?
I'm going to kind of say a cheat answer, because I'm going to say a reason for each one. So Canada is amazing. I think it's great because it's a different kind of skiing to maybe if you've only skied in Europe. There's loads of tree skiing. There's lots of powder skiing. If you go to Whistler or if you go to Banff, there's, depending on the snow of that season, you can get a bad season. No snow, you can get an amazing season. Loads of snow.
Yeah.
I think it's great because it's not too removed from British culture. Very friendly. There's no language barrier. Mm-hmm. It's a great place to go. I'd say Japan, just because of the snow. The snow is the selling point of Japan. It's very, very deep. If you wanted to ski the best powder snow of your life, Japan is the place. Culturally, completely different to anything you will have experienced, if you've never been that side of the world. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful country. And again, very friendly people. Maybe they don't understand you as much as you expect them to, maybe.
Yeah.
And then Austria. I love Austria because it's kind of got that balance between you've got amazing skiing, very friendly people, there's an hour time difference, and it's a two-hour flight. So it's on your doorstep. Those are the reasons for each one. My favourite, which I'm going to decide now, is Austria.
My question, which I should have asked before that question, of all the places you've been to, where feels most like home?
I think because of my circumstances, I think Austria feels most at home because I'm with Michelle, my girlfriend. We've decided we want to kind of settle down for a little bit here. Mm-hmm. We don't know how long. We haven't put a time limit on it. We're making a home. We've got nice things. We've got a nice apartment. We bought a rug. We bought plants. So I'd say for those reasons, because I'm in a good place personally, I'd say this really does feel like home.
Where's the best summer?
Austria, 100%. I just love it. I think there's so much to do. Like the amount of hiking you can do in this valley, you're surrounded by so many peaks, and you can just be like, oh, I want to go to that one. And then there's plenty of signs and routes and mountain huts on the way. It's just they are like the alpine nation.
What is the best thing, do you think, about Austria?
Just their love of the outdoors and schnapps and
beer. Thought you were gonna, do you know what, that's what I asked you. I thought you were gonna say schnapps.
Yeah. Our landlord brews his own schnapps. Like, he's got his own little like brewery in his house. He gives us a bottle of their vintage every year. I've taken it home to my mum. She drinks it, she loves it. Every time you go around for any reason whatsoever, we went to borrow a rolling pin last week, and we ended up having a shot of schnapps, a shot of rum, a bit of cake and a coffee. And he was like, oh.
It's a good afternoon.
Yeah, it was like, oh, we just literally want to borrow a rolling pin. And it was, and he's trying to like force us to drink all these. I was like, oh, no, we've got to get off. And then Shell's like, come on. Go on, you might as well. So for any reason, when you arrive, obviously, when we get in our Gemeinder form, like a Meldersettel signed, that involves about three shots of schnapps. When we arrived back, they just came round the next evening with a little tray of schnapps. Like, oh, welcome schnapps. Like,
they're just so nice.
Our landlords are fantastic. They're just so nice. Nice people.
What was the most challenging time throughout all of your seasons?
When I was working in Canada, when I was getting paid for 4 hours a day, when I was there for like 8 hours, 9 hours a day, that was pretty challenging. There was one time I got a paycheck that was, I think, about $10 for like a full month's like wage, because I'd had to pay rent and all these different things that came, all the deductions that came out of it. That was pretty hard. That was the season where I was like, Mum, can you send me some money, please? Since that season, I've been much more self-sufficient, because you don't want to get into a situation where you're working, but you can't support yourself. That's ridiculous.
Were there any opportunities that stand out to you that you wouldn't have had unless you had started doing your seasons?
Just the sheer amount of self-confidence it gave me. I feel like when I was working in my normal job before I got my first ski job, I was working in the cinema. I loved working in the cinema, like, because I was really into my films and working with like-minded people, but I wasn't doing anything like, I don't know. I wasn't me at that point. I feel like I became me when I started doing my seasons. I started, sounds really silly, but I found myself, if you know what I mean. I found my self-confidence. Yeah. I mean, I've always been quite loud. And like you say, like I was saying earlier, people saying, oh, you should try acting or something when I was in high school and stuff. But I don't really feel like I really became the person I am now until I started doing this job. I felt like it's helped mold the person I am now.
Yeah.
If that's a good thing or bad thing, I'm not completely sure.
It's a good thing. It's a good thing.
There's not been like a yes or no, like go down this road or this road that I felt like I've done. But just the way my journey to this point has been molded by skiing and doing ski seasons.
What's the best advice you've ever been given?
Ooh, best advice I've ever been given. Get travel insurance. I think there's not specific advice, but the way my mum and dad have been just like, pursue things that you enjoy, that you want to do. They were kind of the ones who said, don't know if uni's for you. I don't know if you're going to enjoy it as much as... I think I was just doing it because everyone else was doing it. That's what I was thinking. And they were like, maybe uni isn't for you. Maybe you find something that you want to do. And once I mentioned a few times that I wanted to do ski instructing, they were quite vocal in the support for it. I'm remembering someone I did a season with in St. Anton. He has a tattoo on his chest and it's like the globe with an aeroplane going around it. And it says it like some inspirational quote, but what we kind of translated it to was, don't let your dreams be dreams. And it's such a terrible tattoo if it was that, but it isn't that. But every time he took his top off, we were like, don't let your dreams be dreams. So that's a definitely good quote to live by.
My next question was, what quotes do you live by?
Don't let your dreams be dreams. Sorry, Ryan, if you ever hear this, I like your tattoo.
Ryan, you're an inspiration.
Yes.
So a lot of the time when you're doing seasons, you are living out of a suitcase. Mm-hmm. Is there something you take everywhere with you?
I'm not as sentimental as a lot of people, I don't think. I take essentials, obviously, things that I need to do, the things I do, like skis and boots. And when I'm traveling, like backpacking, because I do that hopefully once a year until COVID came, with this job, it affords quite a lot of time between, say, the summer and the winter. So you get October to November off. The past 3 years, I've been away for like a 5 week period, traveled quite a lot of Southeast Asia and all that. I always take a bag with me that I can have separately from everything, so I have all my travel documents in there. The one thing I do take quite often now is my Nintendo Switch. I play on the plane. I'm a bit of a gamer, so I like to play games, and it keeps me entertained and passes the time a lot faster than reading a book for me or whatever. So I've got my Nintendo Switch.
Is there anything that you wish someone had told you when you were younger to inspire you to go and do this sort of life?
Yeah, I mean, don't follow the herd, shall we say. There's nothing wrong with the herd. It's not a negative if you've got a proper job and a wife and kids and all that. It's just that's not always the path for everyone. Like my sister went to university and she's got a proper job and now she's got two children. I've got a niece and a nephew, which is great. I felt a lot of pressure from society in general, my mates in general, just like, oh, when you get a proper job, when you settle down, when you do this, what, then you'll understand or whatever. But I asked my friend that. I was like, I remember coming on between some seasons and I was asking him, I was like, oh, I feel like I should be doing what you're doing. Like, have I messed up or whatever? Have I missed the boat or whatever? And he was like, no, we look at you and we're jealous of your lifestyle. Yeah. You don't realize that maybe you're looking at other people thinking, should I be doing that? But a lot of the time they're looking at you going, I wish I was doing that. So be confident. And if it's making you happy, then continue to do what makes you happy. Don't just do something like work in a call center because you feel like you should be working in a proper job and getting a proper wage. Like, it's just...
There are other options.
There are. There's lots of other options out there. It doesn't matter how you get there. And you could do this job and follow this lifestyle and do whatever you want to do for 10 years and then... You've done that. You've ticked some boxes off your bucket list. You've done the things that you wanted to do. Like everyone who speaks to you, like when you're doing this job, they're like, oh, I wish I'd have done it and all this. And just be glad that you're actually doing it because this time isn't wasted time. the amount of experience you gain from doing a job like this is transferable to so many different jobs, so many different industries. It's not something that you can only work in the travel sector. You can only work in, you can transfer these skills to any walk of life, really. It's invaluable experience.
Speaking of bucket lists, what is left to do on the bucket list?
I have the bucket list idea that I want to ski every continent. So I've ticked a few off. Cool. I want to do South America, obviously. I want to go to Chile and ski there. Maybe Argentina. There's a few ski resorts in Africa. There's one in Morocco, I believe, in the Atlas Mountains, and also South Africa. Obviously, I've not done New Zealand or Australia, which is definitely part of my ambition. So yeah, there's a few I've still got to get to. Probably going to be holidays, but I've got that ambition still in me,
That's
burning
so
desire.
Cool. Yeah, what a good idea. Do you have any particularly memorable or unlikely stories from your seasons?
So one that springs to mind is when I was working in Canada, you get the young kids. So we'd have groups of kids, like four or five, that come for just the morning ski, and you'd go skiing with them. It's like a daycare, but you're skiing with them, and they can pretty much ski. It's not much of a lesson. It's more of supervised time on the mountain. But because they're so small, when you get them on the lift, you can take one either side of you, but you've got a group of five or six. So the rule with our ski hill was you have to send the little kids with a responsible adult. So you'd get people come past and you'd be like, excuse me, can you take a kid? And they'd be like, some would be like, no. Some would be like, yeah, sure. So you'd send them off. You keep sending them off. So I would have a group of six. I'd take two with me and I'd send four up with separate people. I'd say, just leave them at the top. They'll wait for me, no problem. They know the drill. And this really kind of sweet lady comes around in her 50s, 60s. And I was like, can you take a kid? And she's like, honey, I'll take two. Aww. So you're like, okay, yeah. And sent off two, sent the other few. And then my two went with me. We go all the way up the lift, about a 5-minute ride, just chatting, singing songs as you do with the little kids. And as I'm getting close to the top, you can see the group of kids that are waiting for me. And the lady that was really nice was like, I'll take two. I sat on the ground and the kids, who were a lively bunch, are just like kind of staring at the ground and not doing much. I was like, this doesn't seem like a normal situation. So I'm thinking, what's happened? Have they tripped her up? Has she really hurt herself or something? Get to the top and all the kids are like white faced, just like not saying anything. I was like, hey guys, what's happening? And she's sat on the floor. I'm like, what's happened? And she's like, what's happened is she's got a fake leg and it's fallen off on the lift.
No!
So obviously you don't know that someone's got a fake leg. So these two kids that are with her have just watched an old lady's leg fall off, ski boot and ski attached, and just been like, what has happened? And she obviously has had to get to the top with one leg, get off the lift and be like, what do I do? So I got to the top. I was like, okay. So I had to tell the lifty, like, her leg's fallen off. It's in the park. Can you go and get it? And basically, I wasn't waiting around with these kids. I was like, we're going to go now. And she's like, it's okay, honey. Yeah, thanks. And I was like, bye. And left her sat there with one leg while someone went to retrieve it. And I never saw her again. Those poor kids. They were like, why did you have one leg? I was like, I don't know. She's fine. It's great. Just forget about that. Maybe repress this memory, children. This is one for therapy when you're 30.
Yeah, you're right. That is a memorable story.
Yeah.
That poor lady. Yeah. Well done for carrying on.
Yeah. Well, it was an awkward lesson after that. And then every time like you give the kid back, you're like, yeah, there's been an incident. What happened? A lady's leg fell off. You might need to explain that to them. She's like, what? Okay. Yeah, I'll deal with that at bedtime. You don't know what's under them salopettes.
You certainly don't. Right. Back in the room. There's only one more question, really, that I need to ask. And that is, have you got anyone you want to nominate to come on the show?
Well, this lady sat next to me here, Michelle, who has shared a fair few seasons with me now. I think she'd be an excellent person to talk to. She's come from a different background as well. Like, I went from the ski instructing side. She came from more the chalet girl side.
Mm. You up for that?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
She's looking at me like she wants to hurt me. She's shy, but she once you get her talking, she'll not stop.
Yeah,
after part one and part two. That bit of Lord of the Rings.
Anyone else?
I would say Angela Kerwin, because she's Shell's best friend. they've got completely different backgrounds, but they're both still doing ski season, so there must be something to it. And yeah, she's got a lot to maybe a lot of insight into different things. She's she's been on furlough on a paddle board in the middle of Lake Garda. That'd be fun. While writing a book, yes. Another person that I've done seasons with, a very nice guy from Madrid called Guar Bermudez Garcia. He lives in Canada at the minute. That's where I met him, and he's still there, the lucky person. So yeah, I think he's a fantastic person to speak to, because while we were doing our seasons, he was doing his degree in architecture, but he's turned that into a job working for ski lift companies, where he actually designs ski resorts and stuff like that in Vancouver. So it's he would be a very interesting person to speak to.
Yeah, second architect as well after Maria. Oh,
okay, there you go.
It's a theme.
Hey, building on it.
Exactly. Rob, thanks again for coming in. Nope. And see you next time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Ah, thanks again to the hilarious Rob Smith for coming on the show. That was so much fun and a massive insight for everyone. If you enjoyed that and are new to the show, then why not scroll back through our earlier episodes, starting with episode 1, where I talked to the wonderful Lauren Lamari about snowy winters and super yacht summers. As always, don't forget to check out the show notes for any links relating to today's show. You can now click to subscribe on any podcast platform to get new releases of this show as they come out, so please click and subscribe. A massive thank you to our sponsors Mike's Sports Bar in Meyerhofen, Wandering Woods Coffee in the UK, and of course thank you to Mondo Wave for the music. Thanks for tuning in, guys, and I look forward to seeing you all again next time.